The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. As usual, this is our week in review show. We've got the Archbishop of Canterbury and the sacred dealer of all things dark and matter. With me, as always, federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin, who may or may not be responsible for drone attacks. We'll talk about that later. And editor at large from CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. And this week, we're unraveling head of our Defense Department, Austin, who's out sick. The Houthis drama. Chris Christie is leaving the race. Looks like Nikki Haley is surging in New Hampshire and Iowa. The Georgia DA, the prosecutor affair, Donald Trump up for 5 minutes in New York court, and Trump may not be able to use SEAL Team 6 to kill his opponents. That immunity plea. We've got election security coming up this fall, Mayorkas impeachment, and, of course, Hunter is indicted and in Congress. And, good Lord, look at the NFL. So that's a lot to unravel. So stick around. When we get back, we'll dive into it. We'll be right back.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, welcome back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekly Week in Review, Just Ask the Press. With me, as always, former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large from CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. And John, let's start talking about one of the things that bothers me the most about the press. We suck. But to be honest, let's talk a little bit about the Austin drama, which you brought up last week. And the Houthis, we have... all kidding aside, we have, this is a dictionary definition of escalation of an international crisis. We bomb them. There's a chance of a widening conflict in the Middle East, although press reports say neither Iran, who is backing the separatists in Yemen, nor the United States say that we want an escalation of the conflict. And yet here we are. And I have sat on the receiving end of a couple of these and haven't been in the briefing room myself this week and have sat on some of the calls and looked at the briefing. And the one question we're not asking and have not asked John Kirby or anybody in this administration is why we have escalated and what's our confidence that we can hold this escalation to what it is? They still deny it's even an escalation. It's frustrating for me. And you and I have spoken, and I know it's a bit of a frustration for you. Bring us up to date.
Well, of course it's an escalation. I've also been curious more. I've tried to focus on what the administration officials are saying and not,
which ain't much,
not much. And not, you know, sometimes our, unique choice of questions. And, you know, it is troubling. It's very questionable that they don't view this as an escalation, that they've avoided doing this really since the Biden administration came into office. It's not like the Houthis are a new problem. Now, they have stepped up attacks and just messing with, you know, container ships and other things on the Red Sea. That's a big deal. This is a big, this is a matter of international commerce and international security. So, essentially, the best that you can kind of piece this together is Joe Biden just had enough of it. And he's warned the Houthis, he's warned the Iranians multiple times, and it was getting worse. And Joe Biden decided to do something about it. But when you do something, the other side is going to respond. The Houthis say they're going to respond. There is commentary out there saying that this is actually a net positive for the Houthis because it will help them get more support from, you know, various countries. And the number one on that list, of course, is Iran. So this will escalate the conflict inside Yemen. And, you know, one thing I don't know if the administration, I think you're alluding to, is I don't know if they've been asked, you know, are we prepared then to step in more directly in that conflict?
Yeah, where does it end? And we have not asked that.
Yeah, where is the finish line on this? Where do we, you know, where does Joe Biden stop his involvement? And does the U.S. now have to get more involved in the conflict in Yemen? Because if you're going to try to degrade the Houthis, that would be one way to do it. Yeah. And it would be one way to weaken Iran's, I don't know if we could call it growing, but they're trying to grow their influence in the region. Right. So it would be one way to get at that too. And they haven't been asked that, and they certainly haven't offered up
any information on it.
Yeah.
And it leaves me concerned. Look, for those who, you know, just a quick background on it. I mean, what they're doing is firing on international waters, on international shipping. And so there's a real economic component to this for everyone. And, you know, internationally, there's a lot of goods that pass through the Red Sea, and bombing it is brings prices up and costs lives. So I get all of the reasons, the economic reasons and the military mm-hmm. reasons for doing what they're doing. But I'm really concerned about us in that briefing room and us as reporters asking the right questions to find out where this leads, because I'm telling you, sitting on the outside, I have no clue as to where it's going right now. And I wonder if the administration does. Michael?
Well, let's, you know, back up for a second. The Houthis sweep down into Yemen from the north and disrupt what was, I guess, as democratically elected government as you get in Yemen. They've been at war with this democratically elected government, as I understand it, for a decade or two. This Yemen is really a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And now, using the Hamas Israeli war as an excuse, they have stepped up their attacks on shipping in the Red Sea, saying that they're doing this, you know, sort of in solidarity with Hamas. The UN condemns it in an 11-0 vote. I think only China and Russia maybe abstained from it. And as you said, they've been warned and they've been warned and they've been warned. And at some point, you have to act or these warnings have no meaning. And so the U.S. and the U.K. and were there not other, wasn't Bahrain and another country also involved in the effort? So you have a multinational effort that presumably occurs after high-level conversations among these countries. And so you put your marker down. Whether or not that causes the Houthis to, you know, sort of see some pride in this and say, well, look, you know, even the U.S., you know, sort of recognizes us as some vital fighting force or something. You know, sort of like when you take credit for a bombing, why you would take credit for a bombing is complicated, but, you know, a lot of it has to do with
credibility, you know,
sort of credibility, publicity, and all that stuff. So this is what's going on there. But you're both right to say, where does it lead? And that's your, you know, responsibility as press people to say, where are we going next? What is the strategic plan? What if the Houthis continue to do this? If they haven't, you know, sort of learned their lesson and are going to go, you know, back north and let what was a peace process in Yemen return, where do we go? What's the answer? And that's a fair question that I don't know the answer to, but I don't think you cannot act. And I mean, this proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran has, you know, sort of devastated Yemen, which is the Arab world's poorest country, or among the poorest countries, as I understand it. And I think over 100 or 150, 200,000 people have been killed. And, you know, they compare this, and have been comparing this humanitarian crisis in Yemen to, you know, among the worst ever seen. So what do you do? That's why I ordered the strikes.
Well, well, Michael, that's a brilliant defense for why you ordered the strikes. But the question for me is, look, the reason why I want to know, and John, you know this from covering defense, they game everything out. They did not take this effort lightly, or if they did, that's even more frightening. But they do this while Lloyd Austin is laid up, and we don't ask the question as to how this was gamed at, how this was done. And as you pointed out last week with Austin on the sidelines, now, they may say it's seamless as hell, and they have said it. John Kirby has been in the briefing room and said, oh, it's still seamless. He's still involved. Well, it's one thing to be on a Zoom call. It's another thing to be sitting next to the president and grabbing him by the arm and go, look, this is not what we want to do, or this is what we want to do. There's a huge difference. And so I want to wrap up this with that conversation, John. I with the bombing, with our lack of questioning, and with Austin on the sideline, to me, this is a very and with Michael calling the shots, you know, wanting the more strikes.
Literally the shots.
Yeah, that's to me. kidding aside with Michael, I know he didn't call the shots.
I mean, Zeldin shoots more than Steph Curry, which is incredible.
Far away, but that's
a very good point, John. That's a very good point.
I'm telling you, it's a huge problem right now, and I don't think we're getting a hold of it. Wrap it up there.
No, John Kirby, the National Security Council spokesman, and if you believe reporting in Axios recently, he's basically the co-press secretary. People can Google that. Interesting piece. Others have followed it. So John Kirby on Air Force One on Friday, contended that nothing was different in the run-up to the first strikes, which I believe were on Thursday, and that Secretary Austin was, quote, fully engaged, end quote, including briefing the president multiple times on mission options and how they would carry it out and you know, everything that goes into it. But you're right. You make a very good point, Brian. No, he's at Walter Reed Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland. He's getting great care from, you know, world-class physicians, and that's great. We hope Secretary Austin fully recovers, of course. There are skiffs there, you know, secure rooms or structures that can handle the reviewing of classified documents and the discussion of them. You know, they have secure phone lines, teleconference lines. They have executive suites. Listeners might remember that when then President Donald Trump got COVID, he stayed at Walter Reed in the presidential suite. There are similar suites for lower level government officials. I asked the NSC Friday afternoon, where is he at Walter Reed? Is he in a normal room? Is he in one of these executive suites? And I was just told that he has access to a skiff. So,
well, what the hell does that mean?
I know. It's very vague. I know, very vague.
I go into John Kirby's office. I've got access to a skiff. I'm in a skiff when I'm in his office. I don't get that. That doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't make sense. I thought that they would be a little more transparent here, and you know, maybe Biden maybe Biden okayed that Austin used the presidential suite. Now, that I believe that's happened before. So they've been vague about that. They're vague about a lot of things. But you make the good point. You know, it's one thing to be on the phone with the president or on a video teleconference, and, you know, the president's sitting in the Situation Room and Austin's face is on a screen. That's one thing, but it takes away exactly what you said, you know, those side conversations.
Yep.
Or the president, you know, someone else is speaking, CIA director, State Department, you know, what have you. Someone else is speaking and President Biden sees Austin grimace, or his facial expression changes, or he just, you know, he doesn't seem that enthused. And then Biden pulls him aside after whatever, you know, after that briefing or that meeting, and they have a one-on-one conversation. So it does limit that. I mean, you know, you're not going to pick everything up, especially if it's just a phone call. And I think they need to explain this better. How involved, you know, can
Austin, we need to ask it better. We need to ask.
Is he medicated? Yeah. Is he on pain medication? No one would blame him for being on pain medication. But if he needs to take himself out of the game, he needs to take himself all the way out of the game.
Right.
And those questions haven't really been asked. The questions, and they've been fine questions. One thing that I'm noticing as I'm watching more and covering the White House a little more is the follow-up question is dead.
Yeah, no shit.
You know, they a few years ago in the NBA, it was the mid-range jumper is a lost art. Well, we've forgotten that's our mid-range jumper. And
yeah,
we don't have that in our bag anymore. We don't have that in our skill set. And, you know, there are a lot of times I'm watching the briefing.
We don't seem to listen to ourselves. We don't listen to others in the room.
I mean, I watch the briefing and there's a question that gets, you know, a third of the way there. And then they move on to another topic and I'm screaming at my television or my laptop, like, no, you have to keep going.
Well, that's the report. That's the sort of the dynamic in the press room, is it not? I mean, you guys, when you're in there, can stay on the same thread. You know, if yeah, John asks, what's your favorite color? And they say, well, we don't really have favorite colors. Brian, when he gets the next question, can say, I'm sorry, can we go back to this question about your favorite yeah colors?
Right.
But instead, everyone is looking for their own little
that's right
2 minutes, and yep, they don't. And so, I mean, I think I find those press briefings infuriating from the standpoint of how the press can't keep a single conversation going, how they keep jumping all over the damn place, and allows the press officer, if he or she doesn't want to move right on. So, I mean, I think it's sort of on you. Just ask the follow-up question. Should be the new name of your podcast.
And by the way, that's a great point. Joe Lockhart, and I can't remember who else it was, told me from the Clinton administration, when they would get up in front of us and they could feel them being zeroed in on one, you know, one, a reporter over here would ask a question and then a follow-up would go, well, wait a minute, you said this. And he goes, I knew that my dancing was done when they would get me in their crosshairs and I had to answer a question. We don't do that.
We don't work. Yeah. We don't work together like that in the briefing room. I started covering and attending briefings at, you know, the last year of the Obama administration.
We used to.
Yeah, there were times back then, I've done it in the briefing room when it, you know, called on and then like, wait a second, you know, you just said this to Peter, let's drill down a little more.
Yeah.
We did it sometimes under Trump.
We did it better under Trump than we're doing it now. We didn't do it yeah well under Trump.
No, we didn't. There were times where, you know, you could, when we worked together, I hate to say it like this, but you kind of backed Sean or Sarah into a corner and then they get frazzled and, you know, they screw up and tell the truth. That's what you want to do. You want to keep at it and keep coming. And they get a little flustered and, you know, you get a little bit of and then, you know, the truth comes out, as Radio's Don Geronimo used to say.
Speaking of truth coming out, the truth of all of this is this plays into the election. With this issue, it's one of the few issues that the Republicans one of the few newer issues, the economy being one, even though that's not really all that accurate in their portrayal of it. But this particular issue is starting to be heard on the campaign trail. And this comes to comes before us as Chris Christie has, you know, left the race. He had a mic drop, said a few things about his opponents, then had a fairly good speech, left the race. And so Nikki Haley is surging ahead in New Hampshire and perhaps Iowa. And she wants to make sure that our she's one of the ones who wants to make sure that you can't retire till you're dead. So how does this affect the race? Michael, we'll start with you.
Well, it doesn't appear at the moment to be having much of an effect in Iowa, where Trump leads by double-digit figures. And more importantly, in the data in the poll, it seems that Haley's supporters are far less enthusiastic, not that enthusiastic for her, whereas the Trump voters were extremely or very enthusiastic for him. So when you have weather at -2, if you're mildly or not enthusiastic, likelihood is you'll stay home and watch football, whereas the Trump people may find their way to the caucuses. So she may actually underperform what this poll reflects if the weather, you know, keeps people home. Another thing that was interesting to me in the poll, and you guys can comment on it, which was a little bit counterindicated to me, with her numbers going up a bit, and it said that her favorability rating in the state overall dropped from December to now, from 59% to 48%, and her unfavorable rating rose from 31% to 46%. So even though her total poll number of 20% had inched up, people are not enthusiastic, and her unfavorability numbers are increasing. That's not good for a candidate. So I can't figure out exactly where they take this. She maybe ekes out a win in New Hampshire, gets clobbered probably in her home state of South Carolina, maybe does better in Michigan, which is an open primary
state,
and then you get to Super Tuesday. So this thing could be over sooner than not.
Well, and weather will have a lot to play. Monday is supposed to be record low temperatures in Iowa. There's snow cover there. How many people get up and get involved in the caucuses is a good question. And, you know, cold weather, bad weather is usually something that doesn't bode well for participation in electoral events, except if you're crazy, and Donald Trump attracts those like, you know, bees to honey. So, John, Christie leaving the race, Haley surging in New Hampshire and Iowa, the unfavorable ratings. Michael, after carpet bombing Yemen, has decided that that it could be a bad thing for going forward. And he's not wrong. I mean, there are those who think this well could be over with by Super Tuesday.
Perhaps I'll drop a hot take here and say this thing is already over. The nomination, it's over. She now has somehow, Haley, despite playing all this fairly well, the Civil War gaffe was a big problem. She's by accepting the money, some of the money that she's accepted from some of the donors that she's accepted it from, she's now painted herself on an island of being the Democrat in the Republican primary. And that will be the dagger argument against her, that, you know, okay, she's going up against Trump maybe. And I agree with Michael that, you know, if she can, the game for her is to finish second in Iowa and have Trump come in under 50%. Juan Williams this morning on Fox News Sunday laid this out. I thought and obviously I agree with him. You know, a good night for Trump is he's over 50% and Governor DeSantis finished second. A bad night, as Juan Williams laid out, a bad night for Trump is he's under 50% in Iowa and Haley finishes second and then on to New Hampshire, where, you know, she's within, in some polls, she's down in the single digits. Her deficit is under 10% to Donald Trump. But I think longer term, it's a big problem to be even described as the establishment Republican in the race, because you're essentially a Democrat and she's taking money, we know, campaign donations from Democratic donors. I don't see a path for her after New Hampshire. I it's just not there. I said this was going to be a clean sweep in the primary, and I was, until a couple days ago, I was ready to come off that and thinking she might win a state or two, but she's not had a good week or two here. I don't know if it's fatigue. You know, this is a marathon, but ever since really the debate before last, not the one-on-one with
DeSantis.
But it's
not a logical one, really. I mean, I understand it's a marathon, but Donald Trump looks tired, old. You've seen some of his recent things. I have too. It's Donald Trump or nothing. I mean, what's left of,
yes,
of the Republican Party is,
you're right,
for Trump and screw you.
That's right. The party is Donald Trump. Trump is the party. That it's that simple, at least nationally. I mean, you know, independent House races or, you know, governor races, you get less of that, but there's still, Trump is still, as a former colleague who I saw in the Capitol this week as we were both chasing lawmakers around hallways, as this gentleman who I have a lot of respect for, and he's been doing this a long time, he said Trump is still the only fucking game in town. Pardon my language.
Yeah.
But you know, the expletive makes the point.
Yeah.
And he is the only show, and you know, Nikki Haley polls in a lot of polls better in a one-on-one matchup with Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And you know, she's a very conservative individual. You mentioned her Medicare and Social Security, what she wants to do, extend the eligibility deadline until all of us are older. You know,
or dead.
She has a more moderate stance on abortion, and that's a problem as well. The party is a purity party, and she, you know, she's taken from Democratic donors.
That doesn't hurt her on a national stage. It hurts her on the Republican stage.
Well, and especially in Iowa.
But remember, what's going to matter also in November is turnout, and you know, if she's painted by other Republicans as too pro-choice,
right,
then people might stay home. And she's not Donald Trump, even though she does poll better against Biden. So
I think that's one of the reasons why she does poll better, because of her moderation on right. I mean, she may not be in the late 20th century, but she's not going to charge people with murder if they get an abortion. So that's right. That will get her some crossover votes. The question mm-hmm. will be, do the people who stay home outweigh those who will turn out for her?
Right.
So, yeah. But
in a way,
go ahead.
Yeah. In a way, I don't want to say that you can't really say that Haley's in a downward slide because she's polling better. But I just think there are a lot of problematic things that have crept up. And it's actually, you would expect that because she was, at least the perception was that she was kind of surging. I disagree with the use of the word surge. Can you surge from 9% to 13%? Is that a surge? I don't think so. Other people do. That's another, that's for another, another show. Maybe
I surged to second place.
But the perception of this surge meant that the other candidates were going to come harder at her and the media was going to become more skeptical and more looking at it with a more critical lens. So, you know, it's just like when a team that's been, you know, fairly mediocre, you know, ranked 20th in the country, you know, they beat a couple ranked teams and they're suddenly ninth in the country. Well, they're going to get everybody's best shot for a little bit.
Yeah.
Look at James Madison, for example. They were ranked, and they're not ranked anymore in men's basketball because, you know, it's easy to get up for the 18th team in the country. So you would expect this. She still has time. And, you know, for her, the whole ball game is really New Hampshire. And if, you know, if she can pull the upset there, the problem then is it's on to South Carolina, her home state. She was governor there for a long time.
And she's going
to
lose that state.
She trails Trump in her own state by 30 points in most polls. So I agree with Michael. I think it's already over. I think by the time the polls close in South Carolina, it'll be the beginning of the end. And who knows if DeSantis is even still around by then.
And with that wonderful thought, we'll leave it on this. We'll take a short break. But Larry Hogan, the former governor of Maryland, came out today and endorsed Nikki Haley. So, you know, she's in trouble. So we'll take a short break. We're going to look at more of the election, but from the other side, from the Trump side, when we come back.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karen, with our weekly Just Ask the Press review of the news of the week. And as we begin this, section, let's talk a little bit about, you know, we started talking about the election, the coming election from the opponents of Donald Trump angle. And let's now talk a little bit about Trump himself. His lawyers in court argued that he has a right to immunity, unlimited immunity, and that he could have a right to use SEAL Team 6 to off an opponent and then sit back peacefully in his retirement and enjoy himself. He was told he couldn't speak in the in his trial in New York in summation, yet he did get up and give a 5-minute filibuster. Then in Georgia, there's talk of the DA and that prosecution of him in Georgia being sour because of an alleged affair between the DA and the special prosecutor. And of course, Donald Trump is maintaining that Jack Smith isn't a legitimate prosecutor. And so all of the charges against him should be thrown out. With that, there was a lot to unpack there, Michael. Let's start with the immunity. Were you surprised by that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, they're in a difficult position. They can argue, as they essentially did, that former presidents have absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for acts undertaken in the course of their duties, although the in the course of their duties part of it was not as emphasized in the argument as they have absolute immunity. So they were asked a hypothetical by the court to say, do you mean if the SEAL Team 6 was ordered to kill an opponent, he could not be charged with that murder? And the answer was yes, unless he was impeached in the House and convicted in the Senate. So their line in the sand is, you can charge a former president for criminal conduct after he leaves office, only if he's been impeached and convicted in the Senate. And that was their bottom line. So if you take that position that impeachment and then conviction in the Senate is a prerequisite for criminal act, then every hypothetical you ask, more or less, the answer is going to be the same. No, unless he's been convicted in the Senate. I think that it came off terribly because the headlines were that President Trump believes he could kill his opponents and get away with it. Whereas I think the argument could have been more nuanced to say that if the acts undertaken by the president in his official capacity form the basis for the prospective prosecution once he leaves office, then he should have immunity. So it's a qualified immunity, similar to the...
But they don't argue qualified immunity. They are absolute.
They did. You know, in the civil context, Bill Clinton was able to be sued while still president because the acts that gave rise to his lawsuit, the Paula Jones stuff, was not part of his official duties. And so he was allowed to be sued. And it seemed to me that the emphasis, now they may have a default, you know, a backstop position of, well, if you don't buy the absolute immunity stuff, then you have to look at his official duties issues. And yes, he was in fact engaged in election security related stuff. And so this was in his official duties. I just think the way that they argued it put them in a very bad place as a public relations matter and with the court. The court did ultimately ask questions about that which was in the scope of one's duty. But I think Trump's lawyer should have said it differently. But, you know, it's a difficult argument to make because if they say, all right, well, fine, we grant you that if there are acts within the official duties, then there are circumstances where he could have some form of qualified immunity. Let's now turn to what Trump did and ask you, counsel, was that in the scope of his official duties? Then you get into this, you know, again, I think loser of an argument that Trump was engaged in, you know, integrity of our elections and all that sort of stuff. And yes, it was in the course of his official duty. So I think sort of either way, they lose that argument. So in some sense, they went all in on the absolute immunity. And I think Brian, they will try to make that same argument in the Supreme Court and hope that they have a better audience there.
Well, but at the end of the day, look, in the argument against that absolute immunity, simply, if the president had absolute immunity, why did Gerald Ford have to pardon Richard Nixon?
Of course. Of course. And of course, the same sort of get out of free jail argument was made by Jamie Raskin when they were saying in the impeachment, well, since Donald Trump has left office, he can't be convicted here in the Senate. And that's, you know, that was the off ramp that Mitch McConnell used, which, you know, as it turned out, was a disaster. McConnell, remember, he says, I'm voting to acquit only because Trump has left office. And as a private citizen, Trump, he'll be held accountable in the criminal justice system. And that's why I feel comfortable in my argument. Well, of course, he was wrong. He could have been convicted in the Senate because the impeachment charges were brought while he was still president. That's the predicate, not where he was at the time of the trial. And of course, now McConnell is being argued against, if you will, by Trump to say that he can't be indicted in the criminal trial. And what Jamie Raskin said was that if you buy this notion of these off-ramps, then presidents have, you know, complete and absolute immunity from accountability. In Raskin's argument, he said, and the same thing was made by Smith's lawyers in court, if you think that he has to be convicted in the Senate in an impeachment trial, then here's your hypothetical. 2 days before the president's term ends, or a month before the president's terms end, he sells nuclear secrets, he sells pardons, he engages all sorts of criminal conduct, blatantly criminal conduct. He does order the SEAL Team 6 to do all this killing, and they do it under the orders of the president. And then he resigns and then he resigns. And so he's no longer president, and he can't be impeached. And yet he's gotten away with all of these crimes. That's the stupidity of the argument. And we'll see how the court analyzes it, but it's hard to imagine accepting such a proposition.
Yeah, that's well. And the other thing we have a hard time accepting, and John, this is one that, you know, Trump for 5 minutes in a New York court during the summation of his fraud civil trial there, proclaimed that he was in fact defrauded. He again was the victim. This is not unusual from Donald Trump. Michael, you've spoken to it, but John, that's to me the epitome of Donald Trump. I'm your savior and I'm your victim. And he's on a revenge tour and he says he'll always love you because he's a victim.
Yeah. Play victim and blame everyone else. You're right. That's just
well, but and can I add, John, one other clause in that sentence is, and say he's doing this for you.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. If they could do this to me, they could do it to you. So he's,
isn't,
you know,
that the same way as saying no one is above the law? I suppose so.
At the end of the day,
every time I hear them say that, if they can do this to me, they can do it to you. I'm going, yeah, if you break a law, if you're a criminal, and I remember, here's the thing that pisses me off about all of it. I remember the day in the White House briefing room when I asked Sarah Huckabee Sanders, I said, does the president think that he's above the law? She said, of course not. No, we would never make that claim. And yet that's what his claim has been from day one.
Yeah. And another thing about the argument is, and I believe one of the appellate judges asked this question during just a remarkable hearing the other day, asked Trump's lawyers, this is the opposite of what other Trump lawyers argued during one of the Senate impeachment trials. Back then they said, well, you know, he won't be president and the criminal courts are where this should play out, not in the Senate chamber. And now they're arguing the opposite. So there's no logic really here. And the three appellate judges did not sound at all impressed with the Trump team's argument. I mean, you saw
on immunity. You're talking about
after, yeah. You saw headlines after that. Took a scalpel to it. They roasted them. We don't trot those headlines out every day. Okay, those are special headlines, everybody. but they came out Tuesday, and for good reason.
So Michael, let me ask you: is that you think he has any chance of having his immunity defended? This is going to end up at the Supreme Court, isn't it?
Well, it could, but you know, there's an interesting little sort of wrinkle to this, which is Jack Smith thinking that, well, this is going to end up in the Supreme Court anyway, asked the Supreme Court to skip this middle court and just take it straight away. And the court said, no, thank you. We want to hear from them. And so if this intermediary court comes out with a 3-0 forceful ruling saying that the argument is unfounded,
where you're going
historically and all this stuff, maybe the Supreme Court says, you know what? We don't need to take this case.
I've thought about that too. Did the Supreme Court make a strategic move so they don't have to take up this issue?
Yeah, they may not have to. I mean, these are two Biden and one George H.W. Bush judges. Henderson, the H.W. Bush judge, is, you know, a pretty conservative judge. And if they come out with a 3-0 forceful decision, it may give the Supreme Court the off-ramp of saying this has been decided and we just decline cert. And there's some logic to that in the sense that this seems to be a relatively straightforward case from immunity shouldn't be granted. In the oral argument, Trump's lawyers raised the question of, well, if former President Obama ordered drone strikes, as he did, and American citizens abroad were killed, could we charge him under, you know, sort of violations of international criminal law and all that sort of stuff? And aren't you opening the door for that if you don't grant absolute immunity? Well, the Supreme Court might say, well, you know what? The Trump case is straightforward. The facts are pretty clear. Insurrection is not really a tolerable act. But if someone were to bring a case like that against the former president for George W. Bush's border policy or Biden's border policy or my Hutu strikes, you know, if you wanted to bring that, then the Supreme Court would say, well, look, under those circumstances, we are going to evaluate what constitutes official acts. And so we're going to wait for that sort of case to come to us to decide this immunity question. We don't need to do it on something that's as black and white as this one.
It's stupid.
So, you know, so you'd think that it's headed to the Supreme Court, but it may not end up there depending on what the Court of Appeals says and how forcefully and unanimously it says it. If it says it in a 2-1 decision, or if, you know, they have a unanimous decision, but this is a close case and language that's a little bit more squishy, then the Supreme Court, I think, probably is under a little bit more pressure to take it themselves. So we'll see how they order it. And hopefully they'll get their, you know, decision out in the next week or two, you know, or three.
Yeah. That's so the trifecta that I had brought up, the last one, and I guess the more curious of all of this, is the state charges. If Donald Trump is reelected, if we go down that path and he ends up getting reelected, he could get rid of all the federal charges, supposedly, you know, grant himself immunity from that, or so give himself a pass. But the one he couldn't is Georgia. Yet in Georgia, in, I believe it's February, there's going to be a hearing over the Georgia DA, Willis, and the prosecutor, the special prosecutor, being involved in an extramarital affair. How serious, Michael, is this a challenge to the charges against Donald Trump in Georgia?
Well, let's take a step back and see what's at play here. This guy, Wade, who is the special counsel that the DA, Fannie Willis, brought in, is in a very bitter divorce. And in that divorce case, his wife has made certain allegations about him and extramarital affairs. And in fact, Wade was held in contempt in the divorce court for not putting his documents in the records that were subpoenaed for him. So one of the co-defendants in the Georgia case, the Republican operative Roman, files a motion picking up on the divorce filings by the wife, and says they had an affair. There was no factual basis for it, but he's just, you know, sort of riffing on what the wife says in the divorce proceedings. So the judge, Scott McAfee, says, let's have a hearing about this. I want to hear from the parties about this. Now, so if the question is, does this undermine the integrity of the prosecution itself? Is this a basis by which the indictment will be dismissed in Georgia? I think the answer is no. Could it cause the judge to disqualify Fannie Willis or Wade from Nathan Wade from prosecuting the case individually? Maybe. Maybe, he says, you know, this is a terrible appearance and I'm gonna recuse you two from the case. Remember, this happened to Willis previously. She held a fundraiser for someone who was a co-defendant in this case. Oh God, Burt Jones, I think his name is. He was an elector, right? And he's like the current lieutenant governor anyway. And Fannie Willis held a fundraiser for his opponent. And the judge said, no, that's not possible. You can't hold a fundraiser for this guy's opponent and then prosecute him. You're out. And the prosecuting attorney's counsel of Georgia is still looking for someone now to prosecute that case against Burt Jones. So the judge could say, if there's truth to it, if there's truth to the fact that Wade was hired by Willis, they're in an affair, Wade has made $600,000 in fees for this, and that they are enjoying the spoils of those fees, he might say, look, I don't like this appearance, and we need new prosecutors. But all that results in is new prosecutors and a lot of argument that Trump can make to a jury in Georgia yes. And it also is an argument to the jurors to say, you see how political this is. This is just a political shit show. And you should acquit me no matter what, because I'm being persecuted by now not only a democratically elected prosecutor, but one whose ethics were, you know, sort of chastised by the court. So come on, jurors, you can't allow this to happen. So there's an argument that can be made. You know, the judge has to be very careful about allowing that sort of argument because it's jury nullification, and that really is not technically allowed. But sometimes you don't have to say things to say things.
There you go, John. This is all part of the appearance versus reality of Donald Trump. He's just going to use it no matter what to delay and to push his. But you can see the concerted effort the Trump team is making to either have everything thrown out or everything in question so he can still maintain his tour. And he is campaigning in court, right?
I believe I tweeted on Tuesday, or was it Thursday, one of those days that he was in court, that we just had the first presidential campaign moment inside a courtroom.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible. He's definitely doing that. He knows in the New York case surrounding his businesses, I don't think it takes a great legal mind like Michael Zeldin's to realize that the judge has already found that the Trump businesses broke the law and did all sorts of shenanigans. And Trump used that. And now they're in the sentencing phase. And, you know, Trump probably realizes that it's going to be a pretty stiff penalty. So why not stand up and do a little campaigning? He knows it's going to get covered. He knows it's going to be, you know, driving the news cycle for the rest of the day and maybe into the next day. So it's almost a no-brainer that he pulled that. I was surprised that the judge reversed the decision. And, you know, first Trump was going to speak and then he wasn't going to be allowed.
Right.
And by midday, the judge has reversed and Trump is speaking in court. So, you know, it's just, I tweeted this too. It's just another episode of the Trump show.
It is. It's just, yeah, that's.
And I'll say this, and this and is kind of
Trump a show.
Yeah, and there'll be another one tomorrow. There, I sensed something kind of in the punditry world this week, and being on the Hill talking to some Democrats for a story that'll be up on Roll Call on Tuesday. Democrats are concerned about the Biden campaign, and part of that concern is just the Trump freight train. It's fully loaded. It's heading downhill, and that sucker's got no brakes, and they know that.
Yeah, they're just hoping it runs off the rails. That's the only hope.
What I started to sense, you know, watching stuff, talking to folks, being on the Hill, there is a sense of inevitability forming around Trump, and I'm not saying that people are predicting that he's going to win the general election. But I think it's starting to sink in with a lot of political professionals that he's got a very good shot at winning in November and being president again. I think it's starting to sink in. And
we'll see.
I just noticed that this week. Yeah. So it keeps up. But a lot of it was Trump was so prominent in the news cycle this week. So we'll see, you know, if we ever get back to normal, if that sense sticks.
Well, one of the things that we've talked about, and this before we go to break, we'll talk about this briefly, is, you know, I sent you guys something that Robert Reich had said, that an indicated fake elector is now overseeing elections in rural Nevada. A Wisconsin fake elector remains on Wisconsin's election commission. In Arizona, the Senate Election Committee Chairman and Judiciary Committee led are both fake electors. Pay attention, the coup's not over. So one of the ways that Donald Trump will try to seal his fate of being the 45th and 47th president, I guess, doing what only one other president has done, two non-consecutive terms, is sealing his fate by bringing these fake electors into the mainstream. Is that we haven't really discussed that much, nor have I seen much on it in the press. John, I'll let you pick it up from there. Yes, John.
Hang on, I can't hear you. Hang on one second.
Well, Michael, you want to take a crack at that first, then?
Well, the sub headline is, and the coup continues, meaning just when we thought it was safe to go back in the water, we realized that a lot of these same election deniers are now running the apparatus of other states. And, you know, we have to always be vigilant to, you know, these sleeper cells in our democracy. And so this is, you know, evidence of the fact that this process has not ended, and that, you know, one has to be vigilant in protecting democracy, because it's, you know, it's authoritarianism is much easier.
Okay, Thomas now, Jefferson, price of liberty is eternal vigilance. I agree.
Yeah. I actually told him, I penciled that out. I penciled that out for him.
Tom, when he was over in the house?
Yeah, he was over. He was a very nice guy. Tall, too tall.
Red haired, kind of like John, had the same color hair.
Yeah.
So, John, your take on it. I mean, fake electors now in the mainstream, that's got to be concerning. And I think that's one of the reasons why Donald Trump sounds so confident. He doesn't really give a shit, because he thinks at the end of the day he can manipulate like he could manipulate in 2020.
Well, this is the guy who got on the phone with the Georgia Secretary of State and said, find me, you know, 11,000 and however many votes that he needed to win Georgia in 2020. So, you know, I fully expect shenanigans in November with some of these fake electors that are now in position to put their thumb on the scales in various states or various counties, various precincts in various ways, which is ironic, because Trump says one thing that one thing the Democrats are best at, and this is Donald Trump, not me, is stealing elections. And now he's got fake electors in a position to influence the next election. It's incredible the way this guy, you know, does stuff, has admitted stuff, is on tape doing stuff, and then just say the other guy's doing it.
Yeah.
And his supporters and a lot of Republicans just go along with it. They believe it as if it's gospel. After all, it came from the mouth of the Donald.
And on that, the mouth of the Donald, that could be a book. Anyway, we're gonna take a short break, and when we come back, we have a lot more to unpack, so stick with us.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekly catch-up on all that's news. Just Ask the Press, as usual, with me is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large from CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. And we've been discussing the election and a bunch of other drama in the world of politics. Man, I'm going to drop the other stuff that we're because I got to talk about the NFL playoffs. They've delayed one game because of snow. We've seen some people in it that we didn't think we'd see in it. And Bill Belichick, by the way, just proved the point for all his critics. He's stepping down and leaving, proving that he can't win if he can't cheat and doesn't have Tom Brady. But we'll start with you, John. Surprised by the playoffs at all?
Surprised by the Houston Texans. The Cleveland Browns, especially defensively, had been playing as well as anybody, any team that qualified.
They were my team this year. I wanted them.
Yeah, and they just got boat raced by the Texans. C.J. Stroud, quarterback from Ohio State, is having just an incredible season for to be such a young starting quarterback. So the Texans definitely surprised. I did not feel last night like participating in the Taylor Swift game. So I did not. I did not watch that. I did expect more out of the Dolphins offense. I know it was cold and bad weather in Kansas City. But the Dolphins, the Dolphins were kind of the it team for a lot of the season, and they didn't do much of anything apparently last night. So what I am looking forward to is the ritual in Buffalo. The Bills have already put out word that they're going to pay they're going to pay fans who come to the stadium and dig it out before their game tomorrow. It got rescheduled until Monday. And the Bills do this when they have these big lake effect snowstorms. They pay the fans to shovel out the stadium. That's always really cool. So I'm looking forward to that. And I think two great games today, I hope. Green Bay and Dallas.
Who do you predict in that one?
I have learned over the years, you never take Dallas in the playoffs. Just don't do it. It doesn't matter if it's Tony Romo or Dak Prescott. So give me the Packers and the Rams and Lions tonight. I think that'll be a great game. I have some good buddies who are Lions fans, so go Lions.
Yeah, and I think the Rams will have something because their quarterback is a former Detroit Lion, in case you don't know. And I think that's going to be an interesting game. I'm picking the Rams there in the Green Bay versus Dallas. I know a lot of Dallas fans who are already talking about the second round of the playoffs. They think the Packers they're going to run over the Packers and the curse is over. And just because they're in the playoffs, they're going to win the Super Bowl. So I, as a dedicated and long time Packer fan, excuse me, I'm going to relish the thought of them defeating Dallas once again. Dallas never seems to have Green Bay's number, or rarely. Michael?
So the quarterback taken number 2 in the draft, right? CJ Stroud is proving to be, at age 22, one of the best quarterbacks in playoff history. I think the statistic was he's there with Joe Montana and Brady, and that his numbers were that good. I think he had a passer rating of like 150 something or other in the first half of yesterday's blowout of the Browns. So you got to love that story. I mean, this was a team that had won 3 games this previous season, I think. and now are in the second round of the playoffs, blowing out what I thought was a very good Cleveland team who I, in my heart, was sort of rooting for because I liked the Joe Flacco story too. You know, he's home with his parents and he gets a call and then it's, you know, it's Kurt Warner all over again.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
I love those those fairy tales.
Or a Nick Foles story with Philly.
Yeah. So good for CJ Stroud and the Houston team. I've never rooted for a team from Texas in my life. I still blame them for John Kennedy's murder. And so I just can't root for the state, period. And so therefore, I'm not rooting for the Dallas Cowboys. And as you guys said, the storyline of Detroit and LA is just wonderful. It couldn't have been scripted better.
I know.
The vanquished quarterback coming back with the opposing team to the home stadium. It's wonderful stuff. That all said, I almost always, unless the New York Giants are playing, I almost always root for underdogs. And so I'm rooting for Detroit, the perennial underdog. When was it, John? Do you remember when they had a season where they had zero wins? Wasn't it? Weren't they as 0-16 team?
Oh,
weren't they Detroit? The only one?
Yeah, I can't remember when, but yeah.
Detroit hasn't won a title forever. This is, I mean, not
no, but I mean, but they haven't won a title forever. Yes, but I think that they were not too long ago a zero.
2008. They finished a full non-strike, you know, shortened season, with no wins or ties since. That was since the move to 16 games. There were some teams in the past, including the Packers, I think, that went 1 year winless back in the 40s. But to 16 games, they were the first in 2008 to go completely winless.
Yeah, and so you've got to, you know, so you got to root. I mean, just like I rooted. Yeah, I just said I've never rooted for a Texas team, but I was glad to see the Rangers win the baseball because they hadn't won in a long time. And I'm thinking of all these, you know, 90 something year old people sitting on their couch saying, God, I'd just like to see them win once in my lifetime, you know?
Well, imagine how Cubs fans are, you know,
that's right. Same reason I rooted for the Cubs.
Packers. I like the Packers though, because look, last year, I don't like Aaron Rodgers and I never have. I found him an arrogant snot when I interviewed him. I've met of their three big quote, you know, their three famous quarterbacks, Bart Starr, I met in the 80s when I was covering sports. Gentleman, great guy. Loved him to death. It was just as kind hearted as a man could be. Brett Favre, obviously kind of a redneck, but at the same time, I introduced my son to him. He was kind. He was outgoing. Aaron Rodgers is just a shit. So last year, Aaron Rodgers in the same position as Jordan Love, didn't go to the playoffs, lost. And so I think Jordan Love has improved a lot this season. I think he's going to be the franchise quarterback going forward. The Packers have kind of hit the trifecta with, you know, it was Brett Favre and then Aaron Rodgers and now Jordan Love, three good quarterbacks in a row. That's very rare for a franchise to do. So I like the fact that faced with the same situation that Rodgers was faced with last year, Jordan Love came through and the Packers are in the playoffs. And John, I think you're right. The Dallas Cowboys choke an awful lot. They find a way
in the playoffs.
They're Democrats. Lose. They find a way to snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory every time.
And the one thing I think Cowboys fans could feel somewhat confident about is that this is a first year starting quarterback in Jordan Love.
In the playoffs, the Packers all overall are the youngest team in the playoffs.
And a lot of times young quarterbacks, to include Tom Brady, Peyton Manning and others, have to struggle the first few times they're in the playoffs. It's a different game. Everything changes. Mistakes, you know, are just really magnified. So I wouldn't be surprised if Dallas pulls this one out and Love just plays okay today, But they are the Cowboys, and it is January.
They're at home.
As small as we say it.
But they're at home.
Yeah, they're Jerry.
Yeah, they are at home, yeah. But it's also going to be cold there. So we'll see how it goes.
But isn't it a domed stadium?
No, it's open, I believe.
Can't they close the roof in Dallas?
Yeah, but it's still going to be cold. They're not going to heat it. I don't think if there's snow, there'll be snow on the field, but it'll still be cold, I believe. But maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I will say this.
It would be a first, really, Brian, if you were wrong.
It is the last 30 seconds, but that's
AT&T Stadium has a retractable roof, and yeah. I don't know if they're going to have it open or closed.
Yeah, that's and then of course Belichick is gone, and so is Nick Saban. That's the one that I really, we'll close on that. How do you feel about Nick Saban and Belichick leaving?
You know, Nick Saban said that he had been talking to his wife since mid-season about this, and his metric was always, when I wake up in the morning and I'm no longer excited about, going to the facility, going to practice, going to the office, and when I start to feel like I'm too tired to go to work and I can't give the players and my coaching staff, because that's who you're really around every day, right? That's the whole thing. When he couldn't give the staff and the players as much as he thought he could give, he needed to give them, then he would step away. And that's the conclusion that he and his wife came to. And I get it with the transfer portal and the NIL, name, image, and likeness. You're able to help the players get some money. You have to really recruit not only a new class of recruits. You have to kind of recruit your own team after every
year.
So yeah, it's just more hours. It's just more work. And he's in his 70s and he's filthy rich. So, and go enjoy the grandkids and enjoy retirement. And, if Nick Saban misses it and wants to coach again, there will be no shortage of jobs.
Well, and I'll say this, Nick Saban, 72 years old, 5 years younger than Donald Trump, 8 years younger than President Biden, is hanging it up to go with the grandkids. Gosh, I wish there were others who would follow that lead. I'll just add that in there. Michael, you gonna miss him? Come on, it's Saban.
So this is what I'm hoping. Saban for Senate. I don't know what his politics are, but let him run against Tommy Tuberville.
Well, at least Coach Saban lives in the state of Alabama.
And he'd win.
he would win. I think he would win.
It's Alabama. Give me a break.
Yeah. Well, they said that, during the civil rights era, the Bear Bryant was the most powerful person in the state, way more so than the governor.
Yeah.
And that if he had only spoken out a little bit earlier about the importance of integrating, especially his football team, which got smoked by an integrated California team, UCLA, I think, or USC, I forget which, he could have moved race relations forward much more rapidly in the state, but he chose to remain silent. I don't know what his politics were. But Saban running for Senate, especially were he a Democrat, which would make that state election be riotous.
Yes,
that would be a lot of fun. And 72 years old in the Senate is relatively young.
Well, hell, right. Running for president these days, that would be younger than either one of them. But
I'm gonna start printing the t-shirt, Saban for Senate.
Saban for Senate. There you go. But here's something for you, Michael. As powerful as Bear Bryant was in Alabama, he had to leave Kentucky. He was the coach at the University of Kentucky. Had Babe Parilli play for him, who ended up in the NFL. And in fact, Bart Starr, who ended up the quarterback of the first two Super Bowls, MVP, wanted to play for Bear. But Bear went to Alabama. So guess what? So did Bart Starr. And the reason why he went to Alabama is because in the state of Kentucky, he was not the most powerful person. That fell on a guy named Adolf, not Hitler, but Rupp. Adolf Rupp, who was as right-wing, would never integrate his, he did not integrate his basketball team until 1971 and was among the last to do it and lost in NCAA with Rupp's runs in the 60s because he would not integrate his team. So that tells you a little bit about how, if you think Alabama's conservative, folks, welcome to my home state, the Bluegrass State, where a guy named Adolf ruled for years. So
the, yeah, and the basketball arena, notwithstanding that background, is named after him.
Yeah, yeah, Rupp Arena. Yep, yep, yeah. Went to the first game there. Anyway, guys, that's it for this week. I appreciate you sticking around. John, where can we catch you, and what would you like to plug?
Rollcall.com. We will be following all of the fun political news. How's that for enthusiasm?
Boy, you sound enthused. It's gonna be a rough spring, folks. We got to get through winter first. All right, Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, I've just learned how to spell the word doozy. It's gonna be a doozy.
That's right.
I'm gonna be dizzy. It's gonna be such a doozy.
So my podcast is called That Said with Michael Zeldin, and we talk about books. Next week we have a really important book, which is about addiction and recovery by a woman named Jane Fox, who through cooking was able to overcome her addiction. And so, wow, if any one of you have loved ones who are addicted or yourself addicted, and addicted means drug or alcohol, it's a really moving book. And then on the backside of it, the following week, it's Sanjay Gupta, the neuroscientist from Emory and CNN analyst, talking about brain health, how to maintain it, and how to avoid cognitive decline, and also incredibly interesting conversation.
Well, and to avoid cognitive decline, I would limit my interactions with Donald Trump, the Republican Party, and most politicians. But that's just me. That's anyway. The name of this podcast is Just Ask the Question. You can catch me on Salon every week with a column. The name of the book in its third printing now is Free the Press. And I want to thank everybody for listening and watching, for making us one of the top 30 podcasts in Good Pods. Thanks for joining us, and we will catch you next time.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.